we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, August the 19th, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Caroline Carnery.
Hello there.
Jen Dobell.
Hello.
And Denise Swanson, our guest co-host. Welcome, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Today's two interviews will address endangered species across the globe. My friend Patricia Welty, who is an activist from Washington, D.C., is concerned about the decimation of the African elephants, who are illegally poached for their ivory faster than they can reproduce. So she decided to do something about it. She decided to embark on a 2,100-mile hike along the Appalachian Trail in the United States in an effort to raise funds for organizations in Africa that are working to stop poaching. She'll be on the show for our interview to tell us about her hiking endeavors and some of the issues facing the African elephants today. Then today, August the 19th, is World Orangutan Day. To mark this special day, we have Leif Cox on the show. He is the founder of the Australian-based Orangutan Project, whose mission it is to ensure that the endangered wild orangutan species are protected against extinction as their habitats are being destroyed due to the palm oil industry. He'll be here to tell us more about the issues that orangutans are facing in Indonesia and what his organization is doing to help the animals before they become extinct. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned. So, Caroline and Denise, the last time I saw you both was about a week and a half ago when I invited you to join my sister and I at the Happy Herd Farm Sanctuary, which is located here in the Lower Mainland. And they house over 80 farmed animals who have been rescued from the farming industry, and they can now live out their lives in peace on this beautiful property in Aldergrove, BC. So it was both of your first times there, and I would love to know, what did you think about it, and what were the highlights for you in getting to meet the animals that day?
Well, for me, I just thought it was such a joy hanging out with the animals. And our actual volunteer work included picking up a whole lot of goat poo in their area and in their little houses. Yes, and that's what's so great when you come and you've got a few hands, or even by yourself, it's kind of like this work reward scenario. You get to do the work, and then you get to have some cuddles, and then you get to do some work and have some more cuddles, and it's just such a wonderful feeling knowing that your work is benefiting these animals that are rescued, abandoned, neglected, or have had horrible lives. And you just, it's not work when you're doing that, because it's for these animals.
Picking goat poop up is fun, actually. And I'd have to say we did an awesome job at that, because there was a very large area with many goat poops
and
that
goats
abounded.
Poo a lot.
Apparently they
know.
Do.
But their poops are very tidy. Right. And little turtle bean things.
And hard. They're just turtle beans. So, Denise, Caroline's highlight, I guess, was the goat poop, right? And then...
Kissing the chickens.
Absolutely.
Yep. Right.
Kissing the chickens.
Yeah. There was that one chicken that just fell asleep in both of your arms, I think, and was so calm, right?
They love to have their comb stroked. And then they just closed their eyes, and, well, that was trial and error. And then it was just like fell asleep. And now in the picture I have on my Facebook page, it actually looks like I'm strangling the chicken. And I felt the need to explain, no, that's not what you're seeing here. The chicken is falling asleep, and I'm cradling gently this chicken's head.
Yeah, it looked very comfortable.
So was that the highlight of the day trip for you too, Denise?
You know, well, yes, but also these two turkeys, Larry and Mo, very very laid-back turkeys. You know, sometimes how the male birds are a little bit on the aggressive side. Not these. They would just gently, you know, follow us around, keeping just a short little
Larry distance. Just followed us around the whole time. They're like from one pasture to the other. He just kept following us
like
around.
Like a pair of dogs.
Mo was stuck somewhere. That's why I think he didn't come. We didn't discover that till later. But yeah, I just wanted to know, like, what is he thinking? Because he's not saying anything to us, but he was accompanying us.
Yeah, they weren't begging for belly rubs or anything.
No,
they,
not
they
like Lucy the pig
standing there watching. And that's the what I found turkeys are like. They're very, very curious and engaging.
And I just wonder, like, what is going on in that wonderful mind? Like, you know, it just astounds me, and with all the animals as well, right?
We got to wonder their brains. Although very, very different, can actually do the same functions with different types of the parts of their brains that are quite different.
Yeah, so. And we've featured several interviews with ethologists. Jonathan Balcombe was the last one, and that was all about fish, but to do more with farmed animals. We've had Mark Beckhoff, we've had him on the show before. If people want to look up sort of like animal emotion and behavior interviews, you can check on our website at animalvoices.org. So that was a really memorable experience. And I took a lot of videos and pictures. And we're going to be having Happy Herd on the show in the future. And I'll be featuring them on our website and Facebook page then. So you have something else for us, Caroline.
I do. I have a wonderful announcement. And that is that Maritza Oliver, her crowdfunding campaign.
We had her on the show before, too, for a Mother's Day show, if people recognize that name. She was one of our vegan mothers.
Yes, I absolutely remember her. And her crowdfunding campaign has reached her goal of $7,500 as of yesterday.
Yay.
And yay, this means that she will be writing the children's book, A Pig is a Dog is a Kid. And I personally feel so rewarded that we all came together as a community to bring this one home for her. And she's a local author. And I really just, I feel that these books are so important in our society because the speciesism indoctrination starts right out of the womb for most kids. And children are taught that some animals are pets and others are livestock and some are food. And these other ones are called wildlife. And the pets we treat well and everybody else is, well, the chips fall where they may. And a lot of children simply have no idea what is even on their plate, and they don't understand that they are eating a once live animal in many cases. So we really normalize that violence by creating these categorization. And so Maritza's book should help to explore similarities as sentient beings to help make that connection between human animals and non-human animals. I'm just so glad to be a part of that.
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, and I think we need more vegan children's books as well. We featured Ruby Roth on the show before, who is probably one of the best known vegan children's book authors. She has Vegan is Love is one of her books, and it's just so beautiful, and she's got several books. And if people want to check out that interview too, go to animalvoices.org. It's just a wonderful interview. But I'm so glad that we have a local author / activist / vegan mom who lives here, and perhaps we can have her on the show one day too to speak about that. She didn't talk about that when she was here.
It
was a wonderful interview that she gave. If people want to check that out, our Mother's Day interview, and she spoke about what it's like to be a vegan mother. So yeah, congratulations to Maritza, and I donated to that campaign yesterday, so I'll be getting a copy of the ebook, which I'm excited about, and I can totally share that with people who I know who are parents who, you know, everyone wants to instill more compassion into their children, right? And I think that this is one great way to do it is storybooks, right? Now we finally have some storybooks, picture books for children that will explain it from the vegan perspective.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We've got some great events coming up. On Sunday, August the 21st, there will be a free Veggie Fest at the Chariot Festival at Second Beach in Stanley Park at 12:30 p.m. Look for the Meatless Meetup sign. Now, there will be free veggie food for 10,000 people, cooking demos, music on two stages, and a market bazaar. Organizers are asking meetup members to arrive about at 1 o'clock or before, so it will be easier to find each other. And although it is a free event, donations are encouraged. More information is available at vanrathfest.com, and we'll post that on our website.
Canada has codes of practice for the care and handling of farm animals. These guidelines include recommendations, but also requirements, which may be enforceable under federal or provincial law. There are 15 codes for different animal groups. The code of practice for pullets and laying hens has been under review and is now online for public comment until August 29th. The Vancouver Humane Society is of the opinion that the following are serious problems with the draft code: not mandating the phase out of all cages, continuing to permit the routine but painful and often debilitating practice of debeaking chicks, and permitting battery cages to be used until 2036. You can find the online form if you to register your comments, even if all you say is no cages, at the National Farm Animal Care Council website, nfacc.ca, or go to the Vancouver Humane Society.bc.ca website.
On September 10th, a screening of the groundbreaking film Earthlings will be held at Creekside Community Recreation Center, located at One Athlete's Way, Vancouver. The admission is free and complimentary snacks and drinks will be available. So round up your friends and check it out. Please note the change of date from September 3rd to September 10th. The doors open at 6:30, and this event is planned by our own Animal Voices co-host, Daniela.
Animal Rights Advocacy Meetup is hosting writer J.C. Reese on recent insights on effective altruism for animals. Reese is a writer, researcher, and international speaker on the topics of effective altruism and animal protection. In this talk, he'll share his most recent insights tackling questions such as, should animal advocates prioritize veg outreach, like online ads, or institutional campaigns like humane reforms? On the meetup site for Animal Rights Advocacy Meetup, you can find links to recommended pre-reading, snacks provided, but please bring some more to share if you can. This is Tuesday, August 23rd at 6:30 p.m. The address is 6939 Frederick Avenue, Burnaby. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
For our first interview, we have Washington, D.C.-based activist Patricia Welty on the show. She describes herself as concerned about our environment, habitat destruction, factory farming, and wildlife, and she founded the nonprofit called A Vegan Life 2 years ago to address the issues of farmed animals. But this year, she decided to do something for the elephants. She has created a fundraising campaign to protect the endangered African elephants as she hikes the 2,100-mile Appalachian Trail in the eastern United States. Patricia is here today to tell us about her fundraiser and some of the issues facing the African elephants today. Hello, Patricia, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today amidst your hike, which you started on April the 8th. It's 4 months later now, and you still have a few months to go.
and you are in New York State right now. So you're doing this to raise money to go towards efforts to stop elephant poaching in Africa. We all want that, right? If we care about elephants, but not many people would just wake up one day and say, I'm going to do a 2,100 mile hike in order to achieve my goal. So is that what happened? Did you just wake up one day and decide to do this 2,100 mile hike for the animals? What compelled you to do this?
Well, a couple of things, Allison. I've always been very interested in animal issues, and I used to be in the Peace Corps in Africa, so I'm very familiar with the areas that elephants roam in. And the other thing is I used to work on some trail crews that repair the Appalachian Trail, and I met people who had thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail, and it sort of festered for a while, and I thought about doing that. And then I thought, well, I could combine it with raising money to help end elephant poaching. And I had also attended a wildlife conference last November in Washington, D.C., and I was horrified to learn that 100 elephants are killed every day for their ivory. So all of this kind of came together, and I decided the time was right.
I'm not a hiker myself. I'm just wondering, are you a seasoned hiker? Is this something that is sort of in your sphere of something that you would know that you could do? Because I don't think I could do this. This would be completely out of my practical and physical ability to do.
Well, as I mentioned, I have met other thru-hikers, and I always have enjoyed being outside and doing day hikes. I wouldn't say I was a seasoned hiker and certainly not a backpacker. But when I lived in Africa 20 years ago, I was in the mountains in Lesotho, and that really started my journey of being forced to hike for distances and in mountain terrain, because it's a mountainous country. And I have been on two short backpacking journeys, and I just decided I'm in good health, and a lot of it is mental, and I decided that with good nutrition, I could do it.
So I'm curious to know how that has been for you. How has your hike been so far? I want to kind of know all about it. You're doing it by yourself, I think. Is that right? And do you have any adventure stories to tell of anything that's happened so far?
I have a few adventure stories. Every day is a challenge. When I started in Georgia, it was very challenging. There's a lot of high ascents, and it took me a while to get my trail legs, as they say. But luckily, the weather was really nice for, you know, the first couple of months, and that helped a lot. And even though I am doing it solo, I've been meeting people along the way and telling them about the hike and why I'm hiking, and that's always encouraging. As far as adventure stories, one thing that comes to mind, I was going over this place in Virginia. It's called the Dragon's Tooth. It's a ridge. It's very challenging and very deep boulders to climb over, and I remember getting towards the end of that ridge or the Dragon's Tooth and saying to another hiker, well, at least it's not raining. And she said, but it's coming. And the skies opened up, thunder and lightning, and I was completely exposed. And I had no choice but to keep going on, and it was very scary, but I made it.
Wow.
So there have been some challenges like that.
Yeah. So, and what about wildlife? I read on your blog that you had seen 7 bears and some wild turkeys. What other types of wildlife are you seeing?
Well, I've seen some grouse. I've seen lots of deer, chipmunks, squirrels. But the bear are kind of exciting because the first one I saw, it was almost surreal because I had been wanting to see one for so long. And everyone had seen one. And I just kept missing them. So I saw this bear walking along the path in front of me and going in the same direction. So I saw the bear first, and, you know, I just kind of backed off and waited for, you know, it to pests. But it's been so exciting because I've seen like little cubs with their mother and really enjoyable. And I've learned a lot about black bears. They're not at all really interested in us, nothing to be afraid of. So
I learned from you from one of the posts that you made that you're not supposed to run from black bears. So they can outrun you. I think you said that they can run 37 miles per hour, which, yeah, is surprising to me.
Yeah, I attended a lecture given by a ranger in the Shenandoah National Park where they have a lot of bears. And he reinforced that. He said, never run from a bear because they've been clocked at 35 miles an hour, which is the speed limit in the park. So, yeah, you want to, you know, they're not really going to be aggressive, but if you get too close to them and they feel threatened, then you just want to kind of avoid eye contact and back off.
So, wow, lots of wildlife on your journey so far. And I'm curious, I looked up the Appalachian Trail online. It spans many states. It looks like it goes up to Canada and New Brunswick, if I'm not mistaken. And as you said, it starts in Georgia. So you're heading up northward. So how does it work with just your day-to-day needs? Like, where are you sleeping and what are you eating? And you're vegan, too. So what vegan food are you eating?
Well, I'm very fortunate because before I left, I asked my friends, not all of whom are vegan, if they would send supplies to me at various points along the trail. And the food has been just incredible. I cannot thank them enough. So I have wonderful vegan food, which I pick up periodically along the trail. And I carry with me a tent. So I stay often in a shelter area, but I sleep in my tent. And then occasionally I will sleep at a hostel or very rarely a hotel.
So getting back to elephant poaching, can you tell us what are some facts about elephant poaching that you would like our listeners to know?
Well, 95% of all elephants have been killed in the last 100 years.
Wow.
And there's prediction that they may be extinct by the year 2020 because they're being killed faster than they can reproduce. And in the past 6 years, 250,000, that's 250,000 elephants, have been slaughtered. In 2013, more than 35,000 elephants were killed. And this is all for ivory. They've been shot, poisoned, and snared. And one place where I visited when I was in the Peace Corps is Hwangi Park. And in 2013, 300 elephants were killed there by poachers lacing the water holes with cyanide.
Yeah, it's really quite terrible. We've done a couple of interviews in the past about the elephant poaching issues, and not with any of the organizations that you're supporting here, though. And I know your goal is to raise $10,000 for these organizations, so these nonprofits that are working to end elephant poaching in Africa. I wonder if you can tell us about them and the work that they're doing, please.
Okay. Two of the groups that we're looking at, one is Conservation Lower Zambezi. And this is a nonprofit. It's based in Zambia. And the reason I liked this group is it's in Zambia, and Lusaka, the capital of that country, is at the crossroads of the ivory trade. And they work very closely with Zambia Wildlife Authority, which is a government organization. And they support the government with teams that give them fuel, rations, transport, 24/7 control room, operation of the patrol plane to monitor the area, and wildlife support in general. So they also work with educating the community, helping schools understand the importance of natural resources in daily, you know, their daily living. And so people that are working on farms that might feel threatened by elephants destroying crops will understand elephants and look at them in a different way. So I felt that I knew the area and I liked what they were doing. And the other group that is a more recently established group, which is working in South Africa, and they were founded in 2013. and they're all women. They're called the Black Mambas. And so far, they've destroyed over 12 poacher camps. They've worked to reduce snaring and poisoning activities, and they are working in closely in the area of Kruger National Park, and I was at that area, and I just felt like they were a strong presence, and I wanted to support them and their efforts.
And from what I understand, 100% of the donations that you're bringing in on your fundraising page are going to these organizations. None of it's going to fund any of your hike, as you're funding that yourself. Is that right?
Oh, that's correct. Yes, I'm paying for the hike myself. Oh, 100%.
That's awesome.
Yes.
So you're taking on this enormous endeavor to raise money for endangered animals. You know, it's not something that most people would do. So I think you're an inspiration for people who may be listening to this who have thought of taking on perhaps such a similar initiative for a good cause, but they don't know how to start. They don't think they can do it for a variety of reasons. Could you give some advice to our listeners on how to deal with some of the psychological and practical barriers that may present themselves with such a huge idea to engage in and to get it started for a social justice cause as you're doing yourself?
I've always admired people that follow their dreams. I haven't always done that myself. Mm-hmm. But I think that if there's something you believe in strongly and you take that first step and you move in that direction, people will see that. At least I want to believe that people will join in and support you because they see that what you're doing, and I think it can grow. And it's sort of stepping into the unknown in a way, but believing in yourself and believing in your cause. And the other thing is, you know, I started to think about, well, what my legacy might be. What do I want to leave behind for a better world? I'm concerned about our world, and I'm concerned about a lot of aspects. And I thought I would try to do, you know, at least something to give back, because I got so much out of, you know, my Peace Corps experience living in Africa and the enjoyment that I received from, you know, watching elephants, and I just wanted to be able to do something.
Well, you certainly are doing something, and I really admire that. I hope people will go onto your fundraising page, which you can find the address on our website at animalvoices.org. It's a You Caring page. So just to end the interview here, can you just give our listeners an idea of where you are right now and where you need to go to finish your hike, and how much longer was it going to take you?
So I am currently almost at the New York-Connecticut border. And the trail goes from Springer Mountain in Georgia to Catoctin in Maine. It may be extended at some point, as you mentioned, but for me, it'll end at Catoctin. And back, Catoctin Mountain is in Baxter State Park, and it's weather dependent. So it closes October 15th. So I will need to be there by October 15th. So that's 2 months.
Wow. And I know you're following a rigorous schedule. Well, thank you, Patricia, for joining us on the show today to tell us about your 2,100-mile hike to end elephant poaching. You can find the link to donate. The link is at animalvoices.org. Thank you, Patricia. Keep us posted. I'm getting your updates when you're posting them online. And good luck.
Thank you so much, Allison. It was an honor to be on your show.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now for some news. Officials in Canada's Alberta province have said that they plan to ban spear hunting after an American former javelin thrower posted a video of himself impaling a black bear. Josh Bomar, 26, uploaded a 13-minute video showing the hunt, and although spear hunting is legal in Alberta, officials are looking into whether he could face charges for the kill. The YouTube video, which has since been removed, showed Bomar setting a trap for the bear and launching a spear with a GoPro camera attached at the animal. The footage captured him declaring enthusiastically, "I drilled him perfect. That was the longest throw I could ever make." Bomar reports having received hundreds of death threats and has been forced to cut back on his social media because of the backlash. His defense is that he didn't do anything illegal. Now, what is legal is one thing and what is ethical is another. As his wife, Sarah Bomar, also a hunter, has been dropped from the sportswear giant Under Armour after more than 3,700 people petitioned the company demanding that they end the sponsorship deal. Now, Sarah is the individual who videoed the entire hunting ordeal. In other news, Jack the Harbor Porpoise, who lived at the Vancouver Aquarium since 2011, has died. The aquarium says that on Tuesday, he lost interest in food and in play, and that he died before midnight on Thursday. The cause of death has not been released, but we'll be continuing to follow this story.
The United Nations has released a report urging world leaders to encourage consumers to decrease meat consumption. It recommends taxing meat at the wholesale level to raise the price. The report was released by the UN's International Research Panel, IRP, which is comprised of 34 scientists and 30 governments. The author told the Washington Post, "All of the harmful effects on the environment and on health need to be priced into food products. I think it is extremely urgent." The IRP assert that 14.5% of the greenhouse gases contributing to climate change are created by the livestock we breed. Rachel Primack, a columnist for the Washington Post's Wong blog, said the UN's report deserves serious consideration. She said, "It may be delicious, but the evidence is accumulating that meat, particularly red meat, is just a disaster for the environment and is not so great for human beings either." She asserts that agriculture consumes 80% of the water in the U.S., most of that being for meat. Along with a tax, she said, a meat cutback could be achieved by making plant-based diets more appealing and less expensive. In other news, people have been abandoning their pet rabbits at the Helmican Road Interchange in Victoria, B.C. Local volunteers have been busy catching, neutering, or spaying, and then relocating about 100 rabbits. Provincial money spent on anesthetics and transportation is running out while people continue to abandon their pets in the area. In the future, says the Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure, euthanasia might be required. So now the province is planning to put up signs alerting people that dropping off their former pets is not okay. They are also installing security cameras. Abandoning pets outdoors is an unacceptable practice. And people need to be aware that feeding these rabbits hampers rescue efforts, as they need to be hungry to be lured into the humane traps.
Now, a walrus named Zeus is in the spotlight this week at Marineland, Niagara Falls. Philip Demers, a former senior marine mammal trainer at the park, reports that Zeus is grossly emaciated. You can see his hip bones. His skin is falling off his bones. His air sac is protruding. There's no visible belly. Now, Demers used to train marine mammals at the park for 12 years before resigning over the health and treatment of the walruses. And he started a petition now to the Ontario Premier to pass tougher laws governing the care of animals in exhibits, and he's garnered more than 130,000 signatures. We'll be following this story much closely in the future, but at this point, he reports that after 4 years, his legal bills are $100,000, and he's doing fundraising around that. He is one of three people sued by Marineland, including the former orca trainer, who we all know, having seen her in commercials, the Everyone Loves Marineland commercials, and she's been sued for $1.5 million. These suits are commonly known as slap suits and meant to basically never see the light of day in court, but to drag on and wear down the resources of the recipients of these suits. So,
well, thank you so much for the news there, Denise and Caroline. I saw a photo of that poor walrus last night. And it's really sad. So, yeah, it would be definitely good to do some follow-up on that on the show in the future.
Our feature interview today is with Leif Cox, founder of the Australian-based organization, the Orangutan Project, which he personally founded in 1998. He's joining us today to talk about his 30-year connection with these stunning beings and their looming extinction. Tonight, he will host a gala fundraiser in Langley for the project. Leif's academic qualifications include a Master's of Science studying orangutans, and he is also the author of the book Orangutans and Their Battle for Survival. Welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Now, first of all, are there still tickets left for tonight's gala? And if so, where can they be purchased?
Yes, there is. And people can go onto our website, orangutans, that's plural, .ca, or into Everbright, or they can buy tickets at the door at the Klaus Berry Farm and Estate Winery in Langley. We start at 6:30, and we just love to have people come and have a great time, and also understand why we're doing what we're doing.
I'm going to certainly try to get out there tonight myself with my partner. Now, the word orangutan is like no other in our vocabulary, but tell us what it means.
Orang literally means in Indo-Malay is a person, and hutan or utan is it means forest. So it literally means forest person, which is extremely apt because one of my key points I'm making is that orangutans, although they're not humans, are persons, and it's really just a prejudice against their species that we don't give them the rights that we would give to other human beings.
Well, I'm happy to refer to them and to think of them as persons, so let's go with that here. Mm-hmm. And when we look into the faces of these persons, so many of us do fall deeply in love, including myself. They remind us of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Why do you think we feel this connection? And I'm sure you completely feel this connection.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two reasons. One is when you look into an eye of an orangutan, you recognize the humanity, their personhood with them. And that connection, when you see it in the eyes of what you once considered an animal, can be extremely powerful. But the second aspect is that orangutans are one of the most noble species on the planet. So they're a very independent animal, and when you have a friendship with them, it's very non-wanting in a sense. It's very genuine. And, for example, even though orangutans range between 7 and 10 times stronger than humans, and we have known we've at least slaughtered 1 million of them, they've been macheted, shot, and burnt to death over the recent decades and century. Not one case has an orangutan ever killed a human being known in captivity in the wild is because they don't have that killer instinct that unfortunately humans have. And so to connect with such a noble being is one of the most wonderful experiences a person can have.
Oh, that's heartbreaking what you say, though, about just, complete unwillingness to be able to defend themselves even when faced with grave danger. And we share a lot of DNA with these persons, don't we?
Yeah, we share 97% of our DNA with them. And so, although they're actually not our closest relative, obviously chimpanzees are far more closely related to us, which are more warlike and aggressive, such as humans are, their closeness means, we can far more easily relate to them than perhaps other beings that we share the planet with.
And how long do they live?
Well, we don't actually know because, as long as we've been studying orangutans in the wild, we know that orangutans have been living in the wild. But because they're the slowest reproducing species in the world, which is one of the reasons that they're so prone to extinction, we know they must live at least into the early 60s in the wild for the species to survive continually.
And what is their gestation period, and how long do they need to stay with their babies when they're young?
Yeah, they're very similar to us, almost 9 months, about 8.5 month gestation period. The infant suckles for up to 6 years, and they stay with the mother from 9 to 12 years. Now, the reason this is, unlike lower animals who predominantly adapt to the environment through natural selection, like us, they adapt to the environment through culture. And so the babies are born with these vacant brains, and the mother instills and learns the culture into their vacant minds, which makes them uniquely and incredibly adapted to each environment. However, that means they invest a lot of time and effort into very few offspring, which means in situations, if you only kill 1% of the population of females each year, the population quickly spirals to extinction.
Oh, what a tremendous loss that is to lose one child or possibly two babies, because then it's just all over probably for that mother. Now, Leif, we've profiled the struggle of orangutans on Animal Voices before, but given the progressively catastrophic situation for these animals, we need you to bring us up to speed on what's happening now. And my understanding is that we're dealing with two species here, the Sumatran orangutan and also the Bornean species, the former of which is critically endangered, the latter of which is endangered. And many of us have seen the pictures of the remains of charred orangutans on the ground or entirely emaciated, but still alive animals, persons, I'll say, on the ground with babies latched onto them. These images are shocking. So tell us, what's behind this horrifying reality?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I'll update you. Just very recently, at the Population Habitat and Viability Analysis Workshop, Bornean orangutans have now joined the Sumatran as critically endangered. But the current situation is we're fighting over the scraps of remaining forest. 80% of orangutans now live in degraded forests outside of protected habitats. And so in the next few years, it'll be determined whether we can save enough habitat and therefore orangutans for the species to survive. We can do it, but we have to act now, and we have to act intelligently to make this happen. So we are, you know, purchasing land, leasing land, and have our rangers on the ground to do this, but we have to scale it up to make it possible. And that's why we're engaging people for their support. But more importantly, in some aspects, as what you highlighted, is when we talk about, you know, 6,000 orangutans a year being killed, it seems an impersonal statistic. Yeah, but then being persons and fellow beings as we share the planet with, the extinction of the species is an individual story of horror for each of these animals in a scale that, as compassionate beings, we find it very hard to imagine.
And I've read, I believe I got the statistic off your website, that 3.5 million hectares of forest have been destroyed to make way for palm oil.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about palm oil, if you will.
In a broader picture, Indonesia has been raped. You know, the environment's been raped for short-term profit. Yep. And at the moment, palm oil is one of the major cheap short-term products that you can get from, you know, destroying the forest, getting rich from the trees. You plant your palm oil plantation, in 3 years you can make millions of dollars a year. So although it's totally unsustainable, it's very lucrative. And so although what I say is we have palm oil in virtually everything now in our shelves because it's so cheap, yeah? But it's actually the most expensive product in the world, and that sounds like an oxymoron, but I'll explain. It's only cheap because they pass the true cost of production onto the powerless, and the powerless being, in this case, the orangutan, the indigenous communities, the environmental services for local communities, and because more global warming has caused some destruction of the rainforest, all the transport systems in the world combined, is passing the true cost of this production onto the most powerless, our grandchildren and future generations. And so there's actually no long-term economic reason for this to happen. In fact, it's absolutely madness. So the point is we have to stop a few very greedy people getting rich at the expense of the many.
Now, you know, these are what are known as externalities, right? There's the cost of this item in cosmetics or in food or and even for fuel. But then the real cost is completely invisible to the consumer, isn't it?
Exactly. We pass on the true cost on to the powerless.
Yes. And I don't know if you've ever read the book, The Value of Nothing. And it speaks directly to this issue. It's such a good book on these hidden externalities that happen as a result of our consumer products. So what do you make of claims of sustainable palm oil? Because as consumers, we're trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And companies can and do make all these claims. And what I'm keen on knowing, as our listeners, is this greenwashing or is this a thing? Is this the real deal?
Essentially, bottom line depends how ruthless you want to be. It's all greenwashing, because the rainforest is worth more to Indonesia and the world intact than destroyed and made a palm oil plantation, and particularly it's worth more in this case to Indonesian people and local communities. And traditionally, the rainforest, as you might know, is actually very poor soil. People think because it has a lush forest, the soil must be very rich. But it's very poor soil, and so when they take the trees away, which is all the nutrients and stuff, they burn the remaining scrub. And this is why you see even now they burn the forest after they destroy it. The reason is they want to get some nutrients in the ground. And traditionally, in the Schlesinger agriculture of the local people, is you shift every 3 years because the crops fail for lack of productivity. So this is not a long-term sustainable option for us. It's about just wrecking the environment and leaving a wasteland behind. But not only that, its prime orangutan habitat is peat swamps. And these peat swamps are the carbon stores of our planet. And most of these palm oil plantations actually will end up collapsing into the sea as these peat domes collapse, releasing the carbon in the atmosphere. From any rational perspective, it's complete madness. And so on that level, really none of it is sustainable. In fact, mixed agricultural practices with local people congruent with the rainforest and wildlife actually gives us the most long-term profit. And that's where we need to go if we want to talk about real sustainability.
My co-host, Denise, here has a question for you about your projects.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hi, Leif. Yeah,
hi.
This has been very fascinating. My question, the Orangutan Project is involved in supporting a myriad of projects, and there are too many to discuss here today, but let's try to touch down on one or two that you consider imperative priority. I know that's probably not the least bit fair of a question, but let's...
Limited for time.
Yeah.
it's a very good question. I mean, from the bigger picture, the Orangutan Project is really the only organization that's looking at, in a sense, the strategic big picture. That doesn't mean other people aren't thinking about it and dealing with that. But either organization is very specific in their actions, for example, their research or their education or the community development, or they're very specific in the location where they're applying. And so what we're trying to do is to apply a holistic approach in order to strategically save the two species of orangutan from extinction. But then when we focus down on a couple of projects, I mean, one is that we have joint company with WWF Indonesia and Frankfurt Zoological Society, and we're leasing land because often, in this example, in Bukit Tikapulu, which I'm going to describe, is you have the national park, but a national park doesn't contain an entire complete ecosystem for the wildlife and the ecosystem to survive indefinitely. And so we're leasing land around the national park to create a complete and functioning ecosystem. So not only it provides environmental services for the indigenous and local communities, but it also provides the possibility for sustainable population of the megafauna such as the orangutans, elephants, and tigers.
And how receptive is the government? Now, I understand that that's a big part of your job, is to be negotiating with them.
Yeah, what in the end, it's about land use planning. It's about, you know, the land being designated as conservation, you know, areas, mm-hmm. Enough to provide ecosystem services and maintain the wildlife for the future. Mm-hmm. But so it is ultimately a political decision to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the will to protect it. That's why we do a lot of the protection ourselves.
Right.
And so on the flip side of that, of course, is there's businesses who want to influence government decision and government policy to gain access to the short-term profits of the land. And so our job is to financially support the science so they can't hide behind poor science to make these deleterious decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And we support the local communities, indigenous communities, again, so they can make representation. So the usual argument, this is wildlife versus people, and they're supporting the development for the local communities. Of course, this is actually not true. And so getting local people to be represented and heard is key to that. And, of course, thirdly, we fund court cases against the illegal permits, because essentially all this destruction is against Indonesian law. So you can characterize that big business
mm-hmm.
is corrupting Indonesian officials to issue permits to destroy the forest against Indonesian law. And so we fund the court cases from local communities against both the company and the Indonesian officials to do this, to destroy the business case for destroying our planet.
Right. And wow, you need a lot of help, and we'd like to help you. So we're all the way over here on this side of the world, and we want to get behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of time limited right now, but in a couple of minutes or less, 3 minutes, please summarize what we can be doing as consumers over here. I know you've got a palm oil resistance, but there's all kinds of stuff we can be doing.
Yes, and I think we've just got to give up this idea that we are separate. We're the one planet, and we're destroying the planet at the moment, yeah? And we've got to have look at it globally. So it doesn't matter whether you're Canadian, you're Indonesian. These are borders that bigoted colonial people set up hundreds of years ago. They have no relevance in the modern world. We have to save our planet and our future, and the rainforest is the lowest hanging fruit that we can help save the planet, yeah? And we as human beings, we have a compassionate responsibility to save orangutans and the indigenous communities Indonesia from destruction. So what I ask people to do is donate. God bless you. Regular donations are the best, because we need to keep going mm-hmm. into the future and scale up on this. But also I'm asking, particularly in Canada, because we now have TOP Canada, and with a great team here, we need people with skills and time to contact us, and whether they can support either on the board or doing raffles and fundraising and be enablers within Canada to allow this important cause to scale up to when we can really solve the problem in the next few years.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that it's available to us to adopt an orangutan for $12 a month.
Yes. That's one of the most ways that people love to connect in, because, mm-hmm. The baby orangutan's got to be the one of the most gorgeous creatures on the planet, you know. And what I say is, if you don't think baby orangutan's worth saving, you're dead. You must have no pulse. And so by adopting an orangutan, you get to be, in a tangible way, part of the solution. And because we give the regular updates on how the orangutan's going through the system and back into the wild, you can join the orangutan's journey from, you know, have been rescued off its mother that's been killed and eaten, and to when eventually gets put back into the wild free again in protected habitat.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just reading yesterday also that these beautiful persons are, the mothers are killed and the babies are basically sold into slavery as mm-hmm. status-oriented pets and to go to brothels. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, we've got a wrap now, but Leif, thank you so much for coming on the show today, and we wish you all the best tonight and on the project going forward.
You, You're most welcome, and thank you for having us on board and on such a wonderful program to connect with people. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. To find out more about the Orangutan Project and how you can help out, visit orangutans.ca.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, August 26th. It will be a special show for the dolphins, as World Dolphin Day is on September 1st.
My favorite day of the year.
Uh-huh. We'll be interviewing cetacean specialist from In Defense of Animals, Dr. Toni Frohoff, on her recent research of the top 10 worst tanks for dolphins and whales in North America.
Guess who's number 9?
Here?
Yeah, Vancouver Aquarium.
Yeah. Plus, we'll be discussing the new innovation for dolphins that the National Aquarium in Baltimore is planning, a new seaside sanctuary to transition their captive dolphins to. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're closing the show now with a song it's called A Song for the Orangutan, called Hand to Hand, written by Andrew Chin. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Hand to hand and heart to heart, make a stand, make a start. Brothers and sisters in this earthly family, we are called to care for this, our family tree. I hear a cry from the wild. This could be the end of the line. The right to live, the right to be free. Time is at hand for you and me. Hand to hand, heart to heart, make a stand, make a start. Brothers and sisters in this earthly family, we are called to care for this, our family tree. Earth it burns, nowhere to run, nowhere to turn. The more we want, the more we earn. The world it turns, why can't we learn? Stand, make a start. Brothers and sisters in this earthly family, we are called to care for this, our family tree. Orangutan, come take my hand. Within our grasp, let's make a plan. Reach out to one, reach out for all.
answer the call. Hand to hand and heart to heart, make a stand, make a start. Brothers and sisters in this earthly family, we are called to care for this, our family tree. Hand to hand.